Sepherosa Carroll grew up Methodist in a culture shaped by the sea, and her connections to Oceania have influenced her faith ever since. Now she's a Uniting Church minister and the manager of Uniting World's church partnerships in the Pacific, where the sea both nourishes and challenges religious communities and their beliefs.
Well, I grew up in the Pacific, and specifically the island of Fiji and the western side of the bigger island of Fiji, which we call Vitilevu, in a town called Lotoka. My people are Rutuman, they are Polynesian, and they hail from the little island northwest of Fiji called Rutuma.
Mm-hmm. You describe Lotoka as a town. What was your childhood like? Was it very urban, or did you spend a lot of time swimming and enjoying the sea?
Where I lived was more inland, so it wasn't really on the coast, but it didn't take long to drive, you know, to the sea. And that was really a community time. So it was time with family, it was time with friends. And we did that when we went to the sea or to the beach.
Can you tell me more about your community, and especially your religious community? What were your formative influences in terms of your faith?
Well, I grew up in, the western side of Fiji is known as more the Indian division. So we had a high Indian population. But where I went to school, it was very mixed. So we had Indians, we had Fijians, we had Rutumans, Chinese and other islanders. So it was a very multicultural and also multi-religious context. I grew up in a traditional Christian family with very traditional conservative views. But I mean, in saying that, it was still a very kind of, for me, an inclusive kind of family where my father would, you know, valued us valuing other people and actually, you know, treating them as, well, as human beings like us.
When you describe that religious world as a conservative Christian one, do you mean colonial in its shape, or was there a Fijian flavour? Were there elements of traditional Fijian belief that were part of your religious upbringing?
It was very colonial in flavour. We weren't encouraged to see our culture as being part of the Christian faith. We valued culture, but it ran parallel to Christian faith.
And separately. Right.
Yeah. So the culture is what you do at, say, weddings and, you know, birthdays. And so you'll have the cultural things and then you'll have a prayer. That's the Christian side. But to actually bring the two together, or to see how each could inform the other or enrich the other, that wasn't encouraged. So our Christian faith was very much what we had inherited from our missionaries, and it was very much a colonial legacy.
As part of a faith community, even in your earlier years, you must have heard scriptural stories about the sea or involving the sea. Were there any that stood out to you as particularly memorable as a child?
The one with Jesus walking on water and calming the storm were two stories that actually made a lot of sense to me, I think, growing up. And I think that was because of the context. We had a lot, you know, we're prone to cyclones. You've got the sea, you know. So if you walking on water is like, hey, this is excellent. You know, if I could do that, that's wonderful. But yeah, particularly the calming of the storm and the walking on water were two stories that actually resonated with me a lot growing up.
And Seph, baptism is usually seen as quite an important sacrament in the Christian tradition. Can you tell me about your baptism?
Well, my baptism was infant baptism. I grew up a Methodist. In the Methodist tradition, well, actually across the Pacific, baptism is really important, and that's why it's done at infancy. Rarely do you see an adult baptism, and adult baptisms probably followed the newer religions or newer faiths that came later. But infant baptism is so integral to a community. It's like a naming ceremony. But I have to say, you know, and confess that I probably one of these people that went on, you know, and as I cultivated my own relationship with God, with Christ, it became important to me to actually be rebaptized because it was my way of saying I own this faith. And that was actually a very significant moment because it's the symbolism of being immersed in water and actually out of the water. And that was a really special moment for me. I think at that point of time, it was me saying, I own this faith and I own this walk of discipleship.
And from there, you went on to be ordained as a minister of the word in the Uniting Church here in Australia. Can you just sketch briefly how that unfolded for you as a woman from the Pacific Islands?
The first thing to say is that it's not usual for a Pacific Island woman to consider going into ministry. And by that I mean is we may consider it, but the opportunity to do it isn't always available. So I remember I was 17 at the time and I felt this strong call. I mean, that's what we call a strong kind of inner call to the ministry. Now, at that time at 17, all I wanted to do was tell everyone about Jesus and save the world. But that turned out differently because when I started theological college, the understanding of ministry and the understanding of faith began to change. I guess I realized that it's not as simple as telling everyone about Jesus and saving the world, that there's, you know, a lot more aspects and a lot more parts of ministry. But, you know, it was the start of a journey that also led me not only into ministry but into academia, because part of it was wanting to rethink and reframe the colonial Christian legacy and to actually see it from the eyes not only of a woman, so it's not just gender, but also in terms of culture, and there's also in terms of the post-colonial lens, you know, sort of seeing faith from the underside, as some have called it, but to see faith differently than to the faith that I had inherited. And I guess part of it for me is realizing that salvation is more than just about individual or personal transformation. It is that, but it's more. It is about how we work together as community, but also how we co-create in partnership with God in making this world the kind of place that God would have a vision for. So that's been the passion for me in ministry, is to kind of see and find ways in which those things can happen, in which little transformations can make a really big difference to people and communities.
We're listening to Yothu Yindi with the title mix of Gapu, or Water, from their 1993 album Freedom. It's an arrangement of a traditional Yolngu song from the Gumaj clan of northeastern Arnhem Land, expressing there a distinctive saltwater spirituality. On RN, this is Soul Search with me, Meredith Lake, and I'm speaking with Seph Carroll about the sea and her spirituality. She's rethinking the Christianity she grew up with in Fiji, as a woman, as a migrant, and as someone from Oceania. And you know, in her case, such rethinking actually has a name, contextual theology. And it became a big deal during the 20th century, as the locus of world Christianity shifted from Europe and North America to the global South. And with the end of European empires in Africa, Asia, and the Pacific, local Christian communities asked, what might the gospel mean here, in our culture? Well, in the 1970s, Japan answered with water buffalo theology. Indigenous Australians developed rainbow spirit theology. And in Oceania, Christian thinkers cultivated coconut theology. And I asked Seph Carroll to explain what that is.
Coconut theology was pioneered by the late Sione Aminaki Havea, who's a Tongan theologian and a great leader in the Pacific. And so the reasoning behind contextual theology is to view the gospel from the context of the people. It's not simply, substituting Christian symbols with, or biblical symbols with cultural symbols. It's really about wanting to understand the gospel from within the culture itself. So coconut theology was used as a metaphor because coconut trees are everywhere in the Pacific. I mean, you can't miss them. They're just there. So it's a part of everyday life. And so the beauty of the coconut or the coconut tree is that every aspect of the coconut can be used or is used in everyday life. But in terms of the theology, how Javier used it was to actually look at the theology from a seedling that, you know, it's got to die before it becomes a coconut seedling. It grows into a tree and, you know, at the right time, the coconut will fall when it's ready. And when it falls to the lowest part of the earth. The parallel or the metaphor here is that Jesus, through the incarnation, you know, became human, lived a human life and lived a life of suffering. And at the right time, you know, through death and through his resurrection, was united with God. But the other is that every part of the tree can be used. So the leaves can be used as baskets, the flesh, there's drink, there's coconut juice. And there's also been, you know, that's been carried out through services, through the liturgy, where the coconut juice and the flesh has been used as bread and wine. So in that way, people can relate to how a common symbol that's part of their life can be related to the gospel story.
It's a way of grounding that gospel story very deeply in the, literally in the soil of a community. If the first step is developing this coconut theology that Javier outlined, the second step involves a theology of place. Savati Tawere, a Methodist theologian from Fiji, has been a really key thinker here. Why is place important in a Pacific theology?
Place is integral and critical in a Pacific theology. Because as Pacific people, we are grounded to what we call the vanua or the fenua or the wenua, which is land. But that groundedness in land doesn't just mean soil, it also encompasses the sea, the ocean. So it's a interconnected relationship. Now, my ancestors would have understood that relationship very well and the balance that's needed to keep that relationship harmonious, because they would have understood that if one was out of sync, it would have meant that it affected the other. So the relationship is with Vanua, which is land, the people, and the ocean, the creation. So because of that kind of deep connectedness to land, place becomes critical, becomes very important. The other is that in some Pacific cultures, we have what we call the ritual of the burying of the placenta. So when a child is born, the placenta is buried where they're born, in their village, in their place. And I guess what happens is when you move across seas and you go into the diaspora, you no longer have that connection to the land or to the sea or to creation that you would have had in your home place. So where is my place? Where is my people? You know, and how do we sing a new song in this new land? In terms of the Pacific itself, it is about a disentangling from colonial legacy. We have, he's now passed, but the late Epeli Haofa strongly recommended a shift from the use of the word Pacific to Oceania. And his reasoning behind that was to say Pacific comes with a lot of baggage, you know, smallness, dependency. But Oceania, it's the ocean, it is us. Oceania defines who we are. You know, the ocean is us and we are community, we are people. And the ocean is vast. And so our possibilities are vast. They're not small. They're not limited. They're unlimited. So there you see this connection between the land through the ocean and people through the word Oceania.
And you mentioned, Steph, the challenge of migration and maintaining a connection to place as part of a diaspora. The urgency of maintaining that connection and the difficulty of maintaining that connection it's being exacerbated by the impacts of climate change. The places itself that people were connected to are undergoing a kind of traumatic change. And scientists have pointed out, you know, storm surges and sea level rises, all these dimensions of what's happening. In your work with oceanic communities, how do you see climate change affecting people's connections to place?
It's very traumatic, and it is in the words of former General Secretary of the Church in Tuvalu, the loss of place is the literal loss of a people. And for places, low-lying atolls like Kiribati and Tuvalu, they are actually already experiencing climate change impact. And they're already seeing that in the future, they will inevitably lose their home. So what does that mean for them as a people in terms of their identity, their culture? So it is a big trauma. I mean, I don't even know if there's a word to describe it. In my work, it's actually working with communities, working with people as they wrestle through what that might mean for them. For the people of Tuvalu, I know they don't want to leave their homes, like even if that's something that may need to happen in the future. It's not their first choice. It took me a while to figure that one out because I'm a migrant by choice. These communities won't be migrants by choice.
Such an all-encompassing challenge must have spiritual dimensions for these communities. How is this a theological issue from your point of view?
It is a theological issue on a number of fronts. The first one, you know, that stares us in the face is that of justice, that these people who are suffering the most or bearing the full brunt of climate change impact are the ones who've least contributed to it. And I mean, that's a well-known fact. For me, it's an interesting space to be in. As an Australian citizen, I feel that I've contributed to this problem, to this issue. As a Pacific Islander, I feel very deeply a connection and a responsibility to do what I can to help my people because, you know, we're all Oceanian people. So in terms of, that being a theological issue, justice is one at the forefront for the people of Tuvalu and Kiribati, is that they're asking the international community to live more simply so that they can buy time to actually live in their homes. The other issue is around questions of where is God in all of this? Because the understanding is that we have caused this because of our sin. So therefore, God is punishing us. I guess if you stretch that, you could say, well, yeah, it is a result of sin. And collaboratively, it's a result of everyone's sin because of the way we've treated creation and our God-given resources. But on the other hand, it's some who've sinned more and others are suffering that kind of impact. So that's the question they're asking is, where is God in my suffering? Has God abandoned us as a people? The other theological metaphor that was very popular amongst E. Kiribati and Tuvalu was that the ark would come again. And
Sorry, can you just explain what that idea was?
Right, that God promised never to flood the earth again. And because of God's faithfulness, God will ensure that they will be saved and therefore something in the form of Noah's ark will come again. Now, if you go to Tuvalu, you see water on both sides of this narrow strip of island. It's only 100 metres wide. So they know that they know the reality. Yeah, so that was a theology, a rainbow theology, they called it, where people believe that God would save them. It's not the belief of everyone in the community. You know, the other side is rethinking the rainbow theology and Noah's Ark in a way that enables people and empowers people to engage realistically with climate change impact and about decisions that they need to make for their future. There are at least now three Tuvaluan theologians doing their PhDs working on this very question, different aspects of how God is with them in this journey. The other thing I should say, which is exciting, is the return to traditional or indigenous knowledges. So drawing from ancient wisdom to help them navigate and negotiate the current situation.
Could you give me an example of that return?
Well, in the past, our elders knew how to navigate through using the stars. They knew how to read the weather. So things like if the breadfruit tree leaves turn brown, that could tell you the strength of the cyclone. It could be one, two, or three. It's actually reconnecting with nature and reconnecting with the kind of wisdoms that will enable them to work through their current situation and how that actually can enrich their theology that they're working on. It's emerging. It's this time of negotiating what that looks like. But I guess the breakthrough is being able, being given permission to go back and say, my culture had a lot to teach me. There's a lot of spirituality in my culture that can now be used to help us in the current time.
It's a new wave of contextualizing for theology in Oceania, what you're describing.
Yeah.
And Steph, as part of your role at Uniting World, you develop theological resources to help communities develop their resilience to prepare for disasters rather than wait passively, as you said earlier. Can you talk us through how theology is relevant and useful for a community as it grapples with the impacts of climate change?
It is very useful because it is about getting people to think differently about how they engage with climate change impact, but also how they prepare for cyclones and how they prepare for emergencies. Now, why that is important is, and I hadn't realised this myself until we did a baseline survey in four different countries and got the responses back, but something as simple as someone saying, I don't put my cyclone shutters up because it means that I don't trust God. Now, you know, I think, but that's common sense. You put shutters up because you want to, you know, protect your home, you want to be safe. But it's how being prepared can actually be understood. The theology or the reframing of theology is to actually look back at the biblical stories and the biblical texts and to say is, you know, being prepared is actually part of Christian discipleship. So the resources that I'm working on are looking at preparedness as a mark of resilience, preparedness as a mark of discipleship, actually saying that part of our Christian discipleship is to use our own resources, to use our God-given brains, and to actually use it in such a way, because that is part of honouring God, and that to be prepared is about being discerning, learning how to live responsibly in the world. So theology becomes really important because it's about helping people to think differently about concepts that they may have inherited. And again, this goes back to our Christian legacy. That's not useful anymore. It may have been useful at a time, but times are changing. The climate is changing. So resilience in a changing climate is about being able to read the signs of the times. Now, all these phrases that I'm using are biblical, but I think if anything, it is about enabling communities to have a more life-affirming, life-giving way of living in a changing climate. That's just changing too rapidly and too violently.
Hmm. Seth, what hope does your theology give you for the planet and for its oceans?
That's a tough one, you know, because I think that if you're, you know, we're in the Advent and the Anthropocene, we have done so much damage to creation that we, you know, really, is there any hope, you know, for creation and for us? But I guess for me, my hope comes from working with the communities in Oceania and actually seeing the hope and the persistence that they have in terms of really trying to make a go of whatever the situation is. And for me, that demonstrates faithfulness, perseverance, and it demonstrates resilience. So I think, well, you know, if they are hopeful, then why then should I not be hopeful? You know, that perhaps there is a future. And I guess faith is such that we never really know what the future is, but we are just faithful in the time that we have to make this a better world for all.
The Reverend Dr. Sepharosa Carroll on climate change, hope, and the transformative role of theology. She's a Uniting Church minister and the manager of Uniting World's Church Partnerships in Oceania.